J.C. Corcoran Podcast.
There was an old farmer who lived by a rock. Sat in the meadow, was shaking his fist at some boys who were down by the creek. Feet in the water, their hands on their marbles and playthings. And in days of yore, they met a young maiden. She looked like a pretty young creature. She sat on the grass, pulled up her dresses to show us her ruffles and laces. With the white fluffy duck, said she was learning a new way to bring up her children and teach them to knit. While the boys in the barnyard were shoveling refuse and litter from yesterday's hunt, while the girl in the meadow was rubbing her eyes at the boys just like girls sometimes do, to make it quite clear that she wanted to go for a nice pleasant stroll on the grass and hurry back home for a nice piece of ice cream and cake that stood three layers tall. After dessert, she was ready to go for another walk down by the dock. But then a young man with a sizable roll of 100s and a big bulge up front, he'd ask politely, she'd show him her little pet dog that was subject to fits. He'd reach on over, grab hold of her small tender hands with the movement so quick. She'd bend on over and suck on his soda so sweetly till she finished it. And pull down her panties to rub on her hip that she bruised as she ran down the halls. Cause he tried to force her to lick on his candy so tasty made of butterscotch. And then he spread whipped cream all over her cookies that she had been baking all night. If you think this is dirty, you're f***ing well right.
No, I'm just getting warmed up.
Happy to see you again.
Don't be nervous. Don't be rocky. You're a teenage guest disc jockey now.
And let me begin by wishing you a beautiful look.
Did that voice inside you say, I've heard it all before? It's like deja vu all over again.
And with all that in mind, welcome to the J.C. Corcoran Podcast here at jcontheline.com for Friday, the 23rd of April, 2021. I was just looking at my calendar. As you know, I have kept all of my planners going back to, I don't think it was 82. You know, those things that you used to hang on the wall, and it would be a calendar, and you'd write in, oh, don't forget the dentist on Friday and stuff like that. But I kept more extensive notes than that. And so for the last 30 some odd years, most of them odd, actually it's closer to 40, I can look up where I was, who I was with, what I was doing, if I was on a trip, if I was in St. Louis, if I was somewhere. I have all of that stuff. So I keep all of those notes, and I happen to glance down. And this is one of those stories where guys just want to beat me with a nine iron when I tell them this story. So it's the spring of 1987, and I'd been not working for a couple of months. I had like one of those non-compete things. This is after I left Keishi. It's back in 1987, and I was going to go to Chicago, and I was going to go here, and I was going to go there. And finally, I ended up signing a contract with 93.7 KSD, the classic rock station back then. Now it's a country station in St. Louis. But back in the day, we were converting it from, they were playing the Captain and Tennille. And like feelings, nothing more than feelings. We got rid of all that crap. And over the course of time, converted it into a number one classic rock station. They fought me tooth and nail the whole time I was there. But they made tons and tons, just bushel baskets full of money back then. So anyhow, I signed this contract in the spring of 1987. And the management of the company comes to me and they go, look, we're we have put together one of these massive client trips. And back in the day, you don't do it anymore because everybody's broke. But back in the day, they would take gobs of money and they would say, all right, they would go to, just say like a big Chevrolet dealer or something like that. And about, maybe 100 of their other biggest clients. And they would say, all right, here's what we're going to do. We're going to organize a trip, and we're going to go have a golfing weekend. We're going to put you on a plane, and we'll play golf all weekend. We're going to have parties. We'll have all sorts of fun stuff. And all you have to do is sign on to this special deal for hundreds of thousands of dollars. And as long as you do that, we'll do this. And it worked. And it worked. So the radio station ended up loading up a plane and flying people to California for a big golf outing. And I wasn't available at the time that everybody was flying out. So they said, okay, when can you make it? I go, I don't know, maybe Thursday night. Okay, fine, Thursday night. So I got on a plane and I flew into California. And then there was a limo picking me up. They were trying to impress me. And it worked, by the way. And they take me to this golf resort. And the next morning I get up and for the first time in my life, I play golf. I knew nothing about golf. It could be argued that I still know nothing about golf, even though I play every couple of months. I didn't have shoes. I didn't have clubs. I didn't have ability. But I figure I go out there and play. I mean, how difficult can it be, right? Well, here's the punchline to what will be a very, very unfunny story to a lot of guys who play golf. It turned out that the location, and again, I knew nothing of the significance of this. I just thought, okay, it's a golf resort. They flew me into Pebble Beach. Now, if you know nothing about golf as well, let me just tell you that Pebble Beach is considered perhaps the shrine of golf right behind Augusta, where they play the Masters. And then after that, a lot of people would say the second most desirable location to play golf is Pebble Beach. It's right there on the water. I remember the seals were sunning themselves just outside the boundaries of the course. I remember there was a lot of fog early in the morning. That burned off, and it turned out to be a beautiful day. I was paired with Bob Rowe, the former St. Louis Football Cardinals star from the 1960s. He was a salesman at the radio station that I was just getting ready to start at. So I played golf. for the very first time in my life at frickin' Pebble Beach. I did pretty well, too, by the way. Then I started thinking about it too much, and then I really started to suck. But that's the thing about golf. I know guys who play 2-3 times a week. I don't know where guys get that amount of time, and also I would be bored. I can play 9. If I play 18, I'm bored. I know these guys who play 36 holes of golf. I don't know how they... I don't know. I don't even like baseball doubleheaders. I love baseball, but even that's too much. But, you know, a lot of guys like it. A lot of guys have a wife and kids they don't want to go back to. And so the golf course is where they hang out. All right, Peter Frampton had birthday number 71 yesterday. I posted a really cool picture from back in 1983 at DC 101 Radio in Washington, D.C. That's where I met him for the first time. We had him on the air, it couldn't have been more than 2 or 3 years ago, and that's going to be our featured interview coming up at the tail end of the podcast, and it's awfully, awfully good. By the way, he is going to be doing an instrumental covers album. He's going to use his guitar to represent the vocal lines for 10 songs, including George Harrison's Isn't It a Pity and Radiohead's Reckoner. That available today? I guess it is. I guess it's available today. When we start losing members of the Bay City Rollers, you know that we're not getting any younger. Les McKeown died suddenly at his home on Tuesday. He was one of the Bay City Rollers. He was only 65. This is that time of year where the NFL feels, I don't think anybody's noticing us right now. Let's do something stupid to get everybody talking. And it's the new policy on uniform numbers. And even Tom Brady is pissed about this. This week, the NFL passed a new number policy that limited the restrictions on what numbers players at various positions could play. Linemen still have to wear their usual numbers from 50 through 79 for offensive linemen. 50 to 79, 90 to 99 for defensive linemen, quarterbacks and punters, 1 through 19. But basically, everybody else can go wild from 1 to 49. It's a change a lot of players have hoped for. And then we're going to go back to the number they wore in college, where number regulations are far less stringent, and single-digit numbers have become a favorite of many. It'll be interesting to see how teams dole out these beloved single digits now. And you know, the big fellas on the defensive line won't be able to rock single digits still, but for the most part, it seemed like a harmless player-friendly move, unless, of course, you're Tom Brady. He said, this is going to lead to a lot of bad football, and then added, why have numbers? Why have numbers for either team? Why not just send 22 guys out onto the field without numbers or even colors? Everybody wears white, and then you just have a fucking free-for-all. Now, I would watch that game. Now, you want the numbers of the NFL to go up? That would do it. Just blow the whistle. 22 guys all in white jerseys. Don't even know what team is which. I can't help it. Brilliant ideas like this just spew from my soul like a fountain. I have no control over it. You have very little control over who goes into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They make a big deal out of the fan vote. But, you know, there's something like, I don't know, 2,000 people who vote for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And then they say, oh, go to the website, go to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, because you get to vote. You get to have a say in all this. Well, you know what say you get? Millions of people will vote. You know, we commoners get a vote, but that vote goes into one single vote. So it doesn't matter if 50 million people vote, that only ends up counting for one vote among the 2,000. So thanks a lot, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Thanks for nothing. But turns out Tina Turner has now taken the lead in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame fan vote. Speaking of which, I hope you enjoyed that conversation yesterday with Todd Rundgren, who's about 30 years late getting into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and he's still not. And he's up this year, and I just hope that this is finally the year. Today is National Picnic Day. Boo-boo. According to a new survey, 94% of Americans say they like picnics. I hate battling bugs for my food. And once a bug, especially a fly, if a fly lands on a piece of food that I'm eating, that's it. That piece of food goes into the trash. Flies land on shit, okay? And then they fly around, and then they land on your sandwich. I'm sorry, I'm not taking that chance. 1% of people hate picnics. 5% say they don't like them, but 94% of Americans say they like picnics. And the most popular places to have one, a park, by a lake, on a hill, at the beach, in the back. Oh, that's a great idea, at the beach. Nothing like sand in your potato salad. And in the backyard. And people's favorite picnic foods, sandwiches, fried chicken, watermelon, potato salad, chips and dip, deviled eggs, pasta salad, fruit salad, pie, and baked beans. Now, if we can just get the temperature to go over 70 degrees and stay there for a couple of days, that would be nice. And now this.
Shall we play again?
Michael J. Crocodile Dundee.
Don't be stupid.
My name is Indiana Jones.
Please, don't worry. Whatever you say.
I'll be back.
Oh, I am so proud of you. You know, I watched you very closely. You didn't screw up once.
That's Frankenstein.
Americans love a winner and will not tolerate a loser.
Nothing is over until we decide it is. Was it over when the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor? Hell no!
I have a sentimental weakness for my children, and I spoil them, as you can see.
Rocky Balboa? Never heard of him.
I see dead people.
Yeah, baby! Yeah.
What you got in there, good to eat?
The one constant through all the years, Ray, has been baseball.
Hey, bud, let's party.
Do we have any Mexican-Americans with us today? Well, buenos dias.
Buenos dias.
Listen, I'm going to go. It's been really nice talking to both of you guys.
Absolutely.
The pleasure's all on this side of the table, trust me.
Good luck with your layoffs, all right? I hope your firings go really well.
Show me the money!
Don't interrupt me, honey.
It might happen. Yeah, and monkeys might fly out of my butt.
They're gonna put me in the movies. They're gonna make a big star out of me. We'll make a film about a man that's sad.
All right, Sunday night, 7 o'clock on ABC, it's the Oscars. The Academy hasn't announced a host, So there probably won't be one. The last time they had one with Jimmy Kimmel, and that was back in 2018. Now, the producers think the answer to getting you to watch and watch longer, believe it or not, is longer acceptance speeches. I'm going to repeat that. They think the answer is longer acceptance speeches to get you to watch. In recent years, winners were allowed 45 seconds, and then the producers would start playing the music to give them the hook. But this year, the time limit is going to be relaxed. Director Steven Soderbergh is one of the producers this year, and he says, quote, "We're giving them space. We are encouraging them to tell a story and to say something personal," end quote. He also said the ceremony will be shot like a movie, with presenters like Brad Pitt, Harrison Ford, and Halle Berry playing themselves, or at least a version of themselves. It's unclear as to what that means, but I'm smelling a train wreck here. Soderbergh also was asked what the mask policy will be, and he said masks are going to play a very important role in the story. The topic is very central to the narrative, but again, he didn't explain. I don't know that the length of the speech is the issue. It's the content. Because when somebody comes up there and starts making a speech, especially for one of the big awards, and you're like, wow, this is a big story. Look at this person won. Maybe somebody winning for the first time. And they go into this litany of people they want to thank, and you have no idea who these people are, what they did, why they're important. And while it's nice for the star who just won the Oscar to get up there and, you know, sort of share the moment with people who were behind the scenes who were responsible, it makes for terrible television and rotten ratings, and the ratings just keep on getting worse and worse and worse. Now, part of the problem, and I've been harping on this for years, is, you know, you go back to the 1960s, you turn on the Oscars because it was the only place every year that you would see these people. You know, it's not like it is today where it feels like you got Mary Hart in your ear about 18 hours a day. There's just so much entertainment stuff. Even the news shows don't do news anymore. They do lifestyle stuff and entertainment stuff. And then you've got, there must be 15 different shows that are sort of like Entertainment Tonight that are out there. You've got the E! Channel, and I haven't even gotten to the internet. So now once a year they come on television and say, hey, watch this lousy produced show. We're going to hand out the Oscars, and it's going to be like 4.5 hours long. The whole middle of the show is going to be about, you know, best sound editing in a foreign documentary. Do you care about that? No. Why would you watch it? Now, Steven Soderbergh is one of the driving forces behind some of the best work coming out of Hollywood in the last, you know, 20, 30 years. But I just don't know that anybody is talented enough to save this Academy Award show. And the guy who was the director of the Oscar show for years and years and years, a guy by the name of Gil Cates, we had him on the air, I don't know, maybe this is 10, 12 years ago. He is the uncle, by the way, of Phoebe Cates. And Gil Cates was on as an intro to his segment when we were putting him on the air for the interview. As an intro, he's sitting there in New York, and he's got the headphones on, and he's listening to us introduce him before the interview starts, and he hears this coming back down the line into his headset.
The nominees for Best Performance by an Actor in a Leading Role are Tom Hanks in Castaway, Tom Hanks in Gladiator, Tom Hanks in Before Night Falls, Tom Hanks in Pollock, and Tom Hanks in Quills.
Here's Robert Redford.
As I said, my family couldn't afford a movie. In those days, a movie was for 35 cents. You walked to a neighborhood theater, standalone theater, and you saw two features. You saw serials, Wonder Woman, Flash Gordon, Tarzan. You saw two cartoons, Donald Duck, you know, whatever, Bugs Bunny. And then you saw a Pathé newsreel that showed you what was going on in the front, the war that was going on. So film was a cultural experience, but I didn't know it. It was just what you got. And for me, it was just entertainment. It wasn't until years later that I was in the business making films, and suddenly I found myself at a mall with 20 screens and thin walls and people being shoved into the theaters like cattle and hustled out as fast as possible, only showing one feature, getting them into the concession stands as quickly as possible because they made more money. I realized that film has lost a lot of its magic. from when I saw it as a kid. You took stuff for granted that you now look at and said, God, it was a cultural experience. Film was a cultural experience. You had documentaries in the form of newsreels. You had animation in the form of cartoons. You had shorts, because I think shorts are wonderful. And then you had two main features. And it was all in one experience. I think that's been lost. So of course I feel bad about a lot of things I think were wonderful that you'll never even know about, and your next generation won't have a clue about. I just would hate to see the best part of America be reduced to photographs and old newsreels.
Great stuff, Ed, from Robert Redford and Inside the Actor's Studio. I loved that show, loved James Lipton. We just lost him within the last year or two. All right, birthdays today. Dev Patel from Slumdog Millionaire, 31. John Oliver from Last Week Tonight, 44. John Cena, 44. Valerie Bertinelli, we've had her on the air. She's a party man. She's 61 today. Michael Moore, 67. Joyce DeWitt, Janet from Three's Company, 72. Lee Majors, the $6 million man, can't get it down, 82. Roy Orbison would have had a birthday. Birthdays tomorrow, Kelly Clarkson, 39. Cedric the Entertainer, 57. Barbara Streisand, 79. Shirley MacLaine, 87. And on Sunday, Jason Lee from, oh my gosh, Almost Famous, My Name is Earl, 51. Renee Zellweger, she is Bridget Jones, 52. Joe Buck, 52. Hank Azaria, the voice of Chief Wiggum and Moe on The Simpsons, 57. Talia Shire from the Rocky movies and Godfather, 75. And Al Pacino is 81. Hey, I was thinking about this last night. They're talking about Yachty and the Hall of Fame and stuff like that. I have gotten a chance to see in person, mind you, more baseball legends than I can even believe. I'm old enough to have seen Sandy Koufax play at Wrigley Field. Hank Aaron, Willie Mays, I saw Stan Musial play. I mention all this because in 1954, Hank Aaron hit his first home run of his career. It was 67 years ago. And speaking of sports, Howard Cosell died in New York at the age of 77 on this date 26 years ago in 1995. All right, yesterday, Peter Frampton turned 71. I first met him back in 1983 in Washington, D.C. But then we had a tearful reunion over the phone just a couple of years ago. He was playing The Boat down in South County. Great show, by the way. You get a chance to see this guy do it. Does not get enough credit for what he has contributed to the music world. And in the interview, the whole first part is talking about how, you know, they made him this matinee idol when Frampton Comes Alive came out in the late 70s, and then he was reduced to that. Nobody took him seriously as a musician. Yeah, the album sold 100 gazillion copies, and he made a gazillion dollars. But then it was like, you're like Leif Garrett or David Cassidy. You don't really count anymore. You were just this matinee idol. You were too cute. And you had your shirt off and you had the long hair. You were prettier than a lot of the women in the audience at your concerts. And that's what he was reduced to. And it wasn't until David Bowie came along years later. They had gone to school together. And David Bowie said, I want you to come out on tour with me. I want you to play guitar. And that was responsible for a bit of a resurgence in the career of Peter Frampton. But the whole last half of the interview, we just had fun. Here's a flashing back a couple of years to our conversation
Shadows
with the great Peter Frampton.
So long before my eyes.
The level of appreciation of people like you guys is so high here in St. Louis that the love just hits you like an avalanche on stage. And I suspect that you'll get that sort of greeting and that sort of reception when you play here in St. Louis. So it's something to look forward to.
Absolutely. We always love playing St. Louis. You know, it's one of those places. Audiences vary around the country. If you plump me on stage and just let me listen to the audience, I might be able to tell you what city we were in.
All right. Now, you mentioned George Harrison a little while ago, but a lot of people, even a lot of your fans, don't know that you were actually classmates with a very, very young David Bowie. And after your meteoric rise and then things sort of level off and then things weren't actually too cool there for a while, is it safe to say, is the characterization accurate to say that David Bowie pulled you out of, or at least helped to get you out of, a very serious funk at one point in your life?
I wouldn't say it was a funk. It was just inactivity. I mean, I'd been fired from the record label that I'd had the biggest selling record of all time. You know, so yeah, things weren't great. I was now with another label and just about to do my second record for them. And that's when David called up and said, would you come and play on my record? I love what you're doing, you know, on this last record of, he's talking about my last record. And he said, come and play some guitar for me. So I said, yes, of course. So I'd waited an entire career now since we first played together on the steps of where my father taught, because we were both at the same school where my father was the head of the art department. Now here we are finally on stage together, or in the studio together. And then he said to me, what do you think about going on the road and doing the Glass Spider tour with me? I was more excited about the fact of finally getting on the stage at the same time as David, not realizing at the right off there was method to his madness, and he had seen what had happened to me, gone from the I got everywhere before Comes Alive on my guitar playing and my singing and writing, and but mainly my guitar playing with Humble Pie, and that had got forgotten and overshadowed by the image that people had got of me, of the long blonde curly hair with the chest. You know, he had seen that the musician had got forgotten and the image had taken over, basically. So what I always say is, and I thanked him many times, and I still do, that he took me back and reintroduced me as the guitar player around the world in stadiums. Then we did it a second time in arenas as well. So we did the summer in stadiums and the winter in arenas around the world. So you can't thank anybody more for him putting me in that position. And of course, it was incredibly successful for me and reinvigorated my career and got me motivated again. Then I did an instrumental record that he helped advise me on as well, and helped me get players and stuff, Dave did. And what happens? I get a Grammy for it. So my first Grammy. So yeah, you could say that I owe Dave a lot. You know, always he was always there for me when I was younger. And he was always like an older brother to me, and he's always been there, was always there for advice and stuff. It was kind of family, our relationship.
All right, I got three more quick questions, and please take this one in the spirit that it's intended, because you mentioned...
Oh, God, what is it? Get on with it.
Well, I think you'll see here, you know, because you mentioned you got fired from a record label that you produced the largest selling album of all time from, and they still let you go. In 78, you're in the Bahamas, you flip your car, almost cut your damn arm off. You know, you got involved in that Bee Gees Sgt. Pepper thing that I'm sure looked a lot different when you looked at it before the production began, as opposed to how it turned out. So you've had all this stuff go on in your life, and you are still one of the most remarkably upbeat people I've ever talked to in this business. What do you attribute this to?
My parents. I have to thank my parents for who I am, obviously. I was brought up very well balanced. I had, my father was a teacher. My mother worked at a school, too. So it was all about education. They both are survivors. My father survived 6 years in World War II in every major battle in Europe and Africa. And there's something about us Framptons, I guess. You knock us down, we might be stunned, but we'll get right back up again. I have a strength that I attribute to my parents, and my brother has the same thing. My children, I see it in them too. If you get knocked down and you lay on the canvas, that's your fault. If you get up on 9 and brush yourself off and go for another round, then things, you've got to survive. You can't live in the past. You know what? Okay, have I made some mistakes? I've made some doozies. We all have. But you can't spend your time thinking about that. You have to move on. And I've always had the ability to do that.
You have lived in places like just outside of Cincinnati. I think you're living in Nashville now. For a kid who grew up in England, what is life like as an American citizen, which you are now, by the way? What's you get recognized? How do people treat you? Not when you're performing. I'm talking about when you go into a Home Depot or something in suburban Nashville because you need some rope for something. What's life like and how do people treat you?
Yeah, I don't remember the last time I bought rope. Hang the neighbor, I think. I did hang that one guy. Yeah.
guy. He was asking for it, though.
Yeah, I know. I know what you mean. with great respect, I don't suffer fools easily, but also, you have the occasional person that you'd prefer you didn't meet, but I would say 98% of people, when they see me around town in Nashville, either just smile or, you know, if I'm in Hope Depot in aisle 17, there's a good chance there'll be a selfie taken, you know. So
just hold this rope, Peter.
Yeah, right, exactly.
We'll make it look like an accident. Oh, yeah, my God.
And why do you need that gasoline as well? Well, no, I'm not going to burn the house down there.
So. I don't care.
And there he goes, the great Peter Frampton, 71 years old yesterday, and another J.C. Corcoran, jcontheline.com podcast is in the can for April 23rd, 2021. We are relying on you to spread the word, and a lot of you have really done a great job getting the word out there that we are on the internet every morning at 7 o'clock here at jcontheline.com. Please continue to do so. Tell your friends, your neighbors, stop random strangers on the street and fill them in. Please, we need all the help we can get. Enjoy your weekend. Back here Monday morning at 7 at jcontheline.com. You can also follow me on Facebook at The Showgram with J.C. Corcoran. In the meantime, we've beaten this one to death. Have a good one. See you later. Bye.
The J.C. Corcoran Podcast.